Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.
You are Locked On Nets, your daily podcast on the Brooklyn Nets. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.
And welcome into a late night edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. I believe this is the latest we've ever recorded, 10:35 Eastern time, 2.5 hours after Josh's bedtime, but he is grinding. Josh, how's it going?
Yeah, Gavin, I'm really sleep deprived right now. But luckily we had a great Nets game to talk about, a 19-point victory. So that was kind of nice. I was obviously jumping in and out a bit of my sleep, but I did catch most of the game.
Yeah, you had to pass off on your nightly baby Benadryl that normally knock you right out.
I took it, Gavin. Don't worry.
Okay, good. I'm glad you fought through it. This is the second big preseason victory for the Nets. You might have seen it on the Locked On Knicks feed, but if you hadn't, we'll have it coming out here in the next couple of days. We did a Locked On crossover with Locked On Knicks host James Marcita, talking about that opening game with the Knicks and got into more general stuff on those two teams. And because of that, we might end up posting this one first. But yeah, another superb victory for your Brooklyn Nets. And and I think the most encouraging thing through two games is that D'Angelo Russell, though he didn't shoot the ball exceptionally well tonight, has looked really good playing next to Jeremy Lin.
Yeah, I think that the fit has been pretty good so far. Obviously, they're going to develop more of a comfort level as the season goes on, but it seems like it's working out okay so far, as obviously two wins. I didn't think D'Lo played that great tonight. I still have a lot of questions about how efficiently he can score. He seems to take a lot of pull-up jumpers in the pick and roll and doesn't really get to the rim as much. But I thought he did have a few nice passes in the pick and roll, one specifically to Jared Allen that wasn't finished, and also another one to Mozgov that also wasn't finished. But it's still, he's getting them good looks.
Yeah, that's funny that you cite those two, because I had a note in here that he had a bounce pass to Trevor Booker. That was, we always referenced that a pass he had at Ohio State. I wouldn't say it was quite on par with that, but it looked like he fit it between three defenders and Booker just botched a layup. And that was another big theme on the night for me. The bigs' inability to finish. You kind of expect it a little bit from Jared Allen. I wrote down that, like, I didn't really like his touch around the hoop, but I can at least, when it's only one game of it, I can kind of attribute that to nerves more than anything else. But Mozgov had a lot of trouble finishing. There were a couple times where Russell, really looking like a vet, and Kenny Atkinson made a note of this, his ability in the pick and roll to get by guys and then keep defenders on his hip, draw the big man up to him, and then throw a nice little lob. But that doesn't matter if Mozgov can't put it in on the alley. So you just kind of hope it's early game jitters and guys getting back into rhythm. But that's really something to look out for, because the way the Nets are going to play with shooters spaced out and those two guys attacking their bigs are going to have a lot of opportunities for easy stuff at the rim, and they have to put that away when they get it.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny that actually Mozgov drained a three, and then also Jared Allen had a nice 14-footer from the baseline. So they were showing some touch from outside, but as you mentioned, they really couldn't finish inside. Allen had two particularly egregious misses where basically as easy shots as he's going to get, like complete tip-ins, no one near him, and he flubbed them. So that's obviously not the best sign. But I thought he was really impressive on defense. Do you have any takes on that?
Yeah, he was good affecting shots, and you just kind of see he's so raw right now. Like, and I get this was a preseason game, and he probably fit in a little bit better than he normally would because the intensity was so low. But you can just tell, and I know Kenny Atkinson, after it was either before or after that Knicks game, talked about Allen being a part of the rotation sooner rather than later. But from what I'm seeing, he's just a step slow and just not quite there yet to really play significant NBA minutes, or at least in a way where he makes a positive impact. But you see so much potential. He's just so goddamn long, playing today across from one of the quintessential, like, I would say freaks in terms of length in the league in Hassan Whiteside, and he looked even bigger than him. So Allen really stands out in terms of that. And watching Whiteside, you kind of get a gauge of what Allen could be down the road. I don't think he's anything close to that yet, and it's going to take excellent development from the Nets. But just looking at that guy next to NBA players, he stands out, and I think that is already indicative that the Nets might have made a really good decision at what was it, the 21st pick in the draft, regardless of how good he is right now.
Yeah, and I think there was one play in particular that really shows his defensive potential. He was involved in a ball screen, and he had to recover out on Kelly Olynyk, who shot a three and missed it. And Allen was actually was able to get out to the 3-point line pretty well, and definitely showed his mobility there. And I think especially for a Nets team last year that had Luis Scola, Brook Lopez, Justin Hamilton, completely incapable of getting out to shooters, seeing someone even close to a 3-point shooter, especially from the big man spot, was just a very encouraging sign.
Yeah, and we talked about that switchability with him, and my big thing with Allen was the offensive potential in him as a pick and roll guy, and just providing that kind of vertical spacing. But if he can be that kind of dynamic defender too, I'm repeating myself, but the Nets got a guy much better than where they were picking. But talking about Allen, it kind of makes me think about how this rotation is going to figure out, and it's been a big theme for us all offseason, but it's particularly interesting right now with Caris LeVert and Allen Crabbe both out of the game, because you see guys at those two spots playing really, really well that or at least going into the season, I was kind of convinced we're going to fall out of the regular rotation, and that's Sean Kilpatrick, that scored in double digits for the second straight game, and Joe Harris, who's shooting the lights out of the ball every time he touches it. He's really in rhythm. I don't think I realized quite how much height he gets on those jumpers. He really gets off the ground and still maintains perfect form, which is something only the best shooters in the league seem consistently able to do. But he just looks automatic right now, and it's tough to imagine those two guys not playing. But you kind of figure they're getting replaced by better versions of themselves in Caris LeVert and Allen Crabbe when those two are healthy.
Yeah, Joe Harris definitely does get a very deliberate extension on that jump shot, much like you in pickup.
Yeah, I love it. But, yeah.
Yeah, I think Kilpatrick does a really nice job also playing in rhythm. He always seems to catch the ball on the move, which can really give him a quickness advantage, because he's not always going to have that speed advantage going up against other guards, but that's a really nice way for him to get a shoulder ahead of them and really use his body to get an angle at the rim to finish.
Yeah, he's certainly powerful, and I guess scoring has never really been his problem, but with Kilpatrick, you're looking for that all-around game, 14.7 rebounds, but doesn't get any assists, doesn't get any steals, doesn't get any blocks, and unless he can figure out a way to round that out, I see him kind of falling on the back end and maybe being the first guy called up if there's an injury, but outside of that, I'm just not quite sure how much he's going to play this season. Yeah, those were kind of my general thoughts on this team through two games. I guess from a more macro perspective, I love how many threes they're taking. They started off 7 of 14 tonight after hitting 16 of 32 against the Knicks. Only hit three of their final 16 tonight, so didn't finish with a great percentage, but just stylistically, it looks like it's going to be very similar to last season, but with better shooters and I think better drivers that are going to create better quality shots for these guys. I don't know. I see the potential for this being an above average offense.
Yeah, I think that obviously the Nets weren't making all their threes tonight, but just they were got up a lot of good looks, and that's really important also, just because Kenny Atkinson sits him can create that, and Allen Crabbe being the best shooter on the team will help that a lot when he comes back. I think that the Nets are going to need to shoot a lot of threes. Listen, they don't have that inside scoring presence anymore with Brook Lopez being a Los Angeles Laker now, and no one on this team is really going to be posting up or just commanding an ISO from the low block. So they really need to move the ball, player movement, ball movement, to try to create those open threes, because that's how they're going to beat teams.
Yeah, I'm kind of fascinated to see, and I think the first couple games in the regular season are going to be really telling if they can generate those types of looks against defenses that are more locked in and really selling out to stop the three-pointer at all costs. And if teams do that, what the Nets' response is going to be. We've said time and time again that I think the idea is that Lynn and Russell are going to be so dangerous off the dribble that you can't totally commit to just guarding the perimeter all out. But it's going to be fascinating to see if those two can consistently hit outside, because I think that's going to kind of predetermine whether or not this Nets offense is going to get off the ground. And D'Lo, a guy who shot just 35% from three last year, 1 of 7 tonight. I think he has really good touch. He just doesn't get a ton of arc on those shots, and I wonder if that's something that they're working on with him.
Yeah, that's definitely a good call there. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's probably the first time he's playing in a game in a long time. Obviously, they played Tuesday against the Knicks, but just getting back into game shape, maybe that could be an issue with that lift on his jump shot. But a couple other guys that were really impressive tonight. Spencer Dinwiddie, again, just very solid. On defense, he always competes. We tweeted about this on the Locked On Nets account. On offense, he, again, knows how to use his body, similar to Jeremy Lin and D'Angelo Russell, to create angles and to put the defender in a disadvantageous situation. So he's someone to really watch out for, that he could be a potential guy that really starts to get at least 20 minutes a game, because Kenny Atkinson just can't take him off the floor if he's playing well.
Yeah, well, what were you suggesting to me the other day, a hypothetical Spencer Dinwiddie for Billy Hernan Gomez trade? I keep saying how much I like him, and like, Dinwiddie is a guy I was always aware of but had never really watched before Summer League this year. And you're right, he just plays such a heady game, and I think is kind of the third guard on this team. He's really ideal in terms of playing with that level of intelligence and figuring out ways to just get defenses leaning one way ever so slightly. I talked about D'Lo putting guys on his back. It seemed like Dinwiddie was doing that every single time down, and you just see him have these small little hesitations that give guys an extra inch to hit threes. That's really a high-level point guard play, and obviously if he was a little bit more explosive, you could really talk about him as a starting caliber guard in this league, but as a guy who I think is going to be a good backup, he was a real gem for the Nets to pick up last season, and I think he's pretty clearly separated himself from Isaiah Whitehead in that battle, if you ever want to consider it a battle. Dinwiddie playing 25 minutes tonight, Whitehead playing 9, and obviously that's not the end-all be-all in this type of relatively meaningless game, but just based on how they both looked, I'd be shocked if Whitehead is playing over him in any meaningful minutes. Josh, that's just about all I had. Any final thoughts as we wrap this one up?
Yeah, just quick shout-outs to guys like Quincy Acey and Trevor Booker, playing with so much energy, even in a preseason game. Booker especially causing havoc, whether that's stealing an inbounds pass, blocking a shot in transition, just doing all the dirty things. And then he can be a little out of control on offense at times. I think that's something the Nets fans can get frustrated when he takes the ball coast to coast and just runs into a charge. But he's someone that is net positive on the court for me.
Yeah, him and AC both do a lot of good stuff and a lot of stuff that makes you cringe. I'm not totally convinced either one is necessarily in a rotation on a really good team, but they both have their pluses.
This is a really good team, Gavin. They're 2-0. Are you saying that's meaningless?
You're absolutely right. I stand corrected. That being said, I guess my big league-wide takeaway from watching this game, and that's probably a ridiculous statement, but I like to think I can see this kind of stuff, it's just how ridiculously deep the talent is throughout the entirety of the NBA, and even beyond this game. That's just something I've been thinking about as kind of going around the league in the preseason, even on a team like the Nets, who knows, they might end up being a borderline playoff team, but on a team that most people think isn't really all that good. There are all these guys even coming off the bench, and same thing with the Heat. Just deep bench guys, and guys like Josh Richardson and Tyler Johnson, who you don't really think of as great NBA players, who are just so talented. And I compare that to when I first started watching basketball in 2003. I'd say all the way through maybe 2012, this started to shift a little bit. The bad teams just didn't have these type of guys on the team. I mean, it's in my mind, they're a lot of, I know this is just a very general statement, but these are the type of guys that would be playing on the San Antonio Spurs or the Los Angeles Lakers, surrounded by or surrounding superstars in the early 2000s. And I know that was kind of a weird out there rant, but it's just something I was thinking of late, and it really stands out in games like these.
Yeah, I'm not really sure how to follow that, Gavin. That was a bit interesting take. You know what? I'll give you that.
Yeah, I think it was prompted because then I referenced those two teams because I went back and I watched highlights of like the 2002 Western Conference Finals where I think it was Spurs Lakers, and I was just seeing these guys like Avery Johnson and like young Derek Fisher, who even then wasn't that spry, and like Ty Lue, and I was thinking like, oh, you know what, Spencer Dinwiddie's just as good as Avery Johnson. What's Avery Johnson was starting on this
sure,
finals
he'd be a
team.
Much better coach than Avery Johnson.
Yeah, the little general. And then Tyler Johnson could do maybe like, this is probably blasphemous for, and Lakers fans will hate me for saying it, but maybe like, I don't know, like 80-90% of what Derek Fisher did. And these are just like guys now. And back then those were like key components of championship teams. So I just think the baseline for talent in the NBA, like the theoretically crappier guys are much better than they used to be. All right. That is my
Johnson is really good, I have to say.
Yeah, he is. Would you
he had a great season last year?
All right. I'll throw this one out there at you since we're dovetailing, spinning away now. Would you rather have Tyler Johnson or Allen Crabbe, the two guys the Nets offered crazy contracts to last summer?
So that's taking their contracts into consideration?
Yeah, sure.
I would rather have I think Tyler Johnson's a better all-around player. I think that he's a good defender, solid playmaker, and he's really turned himself into a good three-point shooter. Obviously, Crabbe has the three-point shooting on him, but I think Tyler Johnson can fit in more ways, and he really adds a lot of value to the team that might not necessarily show up in the box score.
Interesting. I kind of agree with you that he's better all-around. For the Nets team, I like, after seeing what, let's put it like this, after seeing what Joe Harris did the last two games, I'm really excited to see what Allen Crabbe, who I think is an even better shooter than Harris, is going to do, getting to take a lot of high-quality three-point attempts. All right, anyways, that's going to wrap up this episode of Locked On Nets with a very quick What Grinds My Gears. Josh, I'll give you a chance to say yours if you have any, but I did the work for you this week, and it was actually related to tonight's game. I'm sure anyone listening heard the Miami Heat play-by-play guy at the end of the third quarter, and it was really funny how he brought it up, and I think he only would have done this in a preseason game where there weren't a lot of people listening, but he started getting into how it was like extremely passive-aggressive, but he was talking about how the Nets like rested starters at the last game of the year against the Chicago Bulls, the game the Bulls ultimately won that left the Miami Heat out of the playoffs. And it was really like kind of reeked of sour grapes. He was just kind of talking about how like the Nets had really not played in his mind a meaningful game the entire season, and then they had a chance at a quote-unquote meaningful game because they could have helped the Miami Heat, which they had zero incentive to do. I'll throw this back at you, Miami Heat play-by-play guy whose name is eluding me at the moment. Maybe you guys shouldn't have been crappy for the first half of the year, and you should have won more games, and you should have beaten out a Bulls team that was decidedly mediocre and blew up this offseason. Just an idea. They could have got done themselves instead of having to rely on the Nets, who, as he wisely pointed out, had no incentive to win or lose that game, so why would they risk their stars? I thought that was stupid and ridiculous, and that concludes my rant.
Yeah, Gavin, I think that's a great point. Also, Ira Winderman, one of the Heat's main beat writers, wrote an article that was also chastising the Nets for resting their players. But at the same time, the Nets had beaten the Bulls a week earlier. Like, rest happens. The Nets don't owe anything to the Heat. It's not like they're in some sort of alliance where they have to yeah. take care of each other and make sure that the Heat make the playoffs. Like, what incentive is there for the Nets? Obviously, what if Brook Lopez sustained a knee injury and they wouldn't have been able to trade for D'Angelo Russell? The salt just emanated so hard from the article that Ira Winderman wrote, and I didn't get to see this part of the broadcast where the announcer brought it up, but again, just calm down, and maybe you can make the playoffs next year.
Yeah, just the idea that the Heat have 82 games to get themselves in the playoffs, and keep in mind, I'd have a little bit more sympathy if this was like the West in 2014 where Phoenix got shut out after winning 48 games. This was the Eastern Conference. If you go over 500, you're probably going to get into the postseason, and they had 82 games to beat out the Bulls team, and the idea that it was on the Nets to do it for them, it's kind of funny to me.
To also beat up the most dysfunctional Bulls team, which was just a disaster last year.
I was counting on Rajon Rondo to swing their playoff hopes one way or another. Anyways, now we're getting salty, and I never wanted to go into that direction. So we will wrap up this episode of Locked On Nets. If you're listening this far, I highly encourage you to check out the entirety of the Locked On Podcast Network. I already mentioned that crossover we did with James Marcita and Locked On Knicks. You can catch up on any NBA team you want. And hey, I know the Giants kind of suck. The Jets are decidedly mediocre, probably not even that good. But if you're a fan of either team, there is a podcast for you, Locked On Giants, Locked On Jets, both putting out episodes 4 to 5 times a week. You can check either of those out on the Locked On Podcast Network. Again, if you're still here, we'd love it if you subscribe to the podcast and give us a review on iTunes. We only have about 3 right now. I think one of them might have been written by a friend of ours. The other 2 could have been Josh in disguise. So please, please, please write
Twitter
a review. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're running a Twitter account now. You know what, Josh? Next time we do an episode, I will say this at the front of the episode because I'm sure everyone has long turned it off at this point. But yeah, we finally got the password from our boy David Wurzburger. So we are on Twitter. We are running the account. We even have a possibly fictitious intern, Alvin, who helps us out. I'm rambling at this point. Follow Locked On Nets. Subscribe to the podcast. Review, rate, check out the entirety of the Locked On Podcast Network. Peace out.